Last year, Grant County experienced a 70% reduction in their overall bat population. White nose syndrome is the culprit that has killed many of our Wisconsin bats. David Drake and Jamie Knack are here to discuss the efforts to prevent further spread of the disease, as well as opportunities for you to help. Hi, I'm John Munson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. David Drake is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and an associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you for having us on, John.
And Jamie Knack is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Always great to have you with us, Jamie.
Hey, thanks for having me back, John.
So let's talk about the bats in Wisconsin. Tell us a little bit about bats as a species. And David, why don't you start? What is their history in Wisconsin?
Okay, John, that's a good question. It's a timely issue, and unfortunately we have to talk about this this insidious disease right now. Historically, we've had 8 bat species in Wisconsin, but currently, and since about the 1960s, early 1960s, we really have considered Wisconsin to be home to 7 different bat species. The federally endangered Indiana bat has not been seen in Wisconsin since the early 1960s, and even when it was here, it was in the very southern reaches of Wisconsin, so it was barely in the state to begin with its historic range. So that leaves us with 7 bat species. 4 of those are what we call state resident species, so they stay here year-round, and all bats are insectivores, so if they're here year-round in the winter when the insects are not, those bats have to hibernate, and so it's the big brown bat, little brown bat, northern long-eared bat, and eastern pipistrelle. And then we've got 3 species that we call migratory tree roosting bats. And so these are the bats that in the wintertime or as the winter is approaching, rather than staying in Wisconsin and hibernating, they hightail it out of here to warmer climates. And the thought is that they're probably active, if not the entire year, most of the year as they go further south. And so that would be the eastern red bat, the silver-haired bat, and the hoary bat. So the 4 bat species that are our resident bat species that stay here year-round, those are the ones that are susceptible to white nose syndrome, which is a fungus that is found in cave systems and mine systems. And the reason they're susceptible is because that fungus is growing in those areas where they hibernate. And so those 4 bat species, as you mentioned on the radio on the intro, is that it was first found, white nose syndrome was first discovered in Grant County in the very southwesternmost county of the state. And since last year, the DNR has been doing surveillance over this past winter and has found it in 4 other counties, Richland and Crawford County, which are also down in the southwestern part of the state, but also up in Door County and in Dane County, they found bats with white nose syndrome. And so there is a couple of things alarming about that is, number one, that it's spread to additional counties, but it's also spread to Door County. So it's really spread from the southwestern reach of the state to the northeastern reach of the state. So it's really kind of spread across the state, which is shocking. A couple other things that are alarming about this, the original cave that was found to contain white nose syndrome in Grant County 2 winters ago, the bat population has been decimated or has declined by 70% in that cave over just one course of a year. And this is kind of common with what's been found, white nose syndrome, where it was first found in caves out in Albany, New York, and in parts of the northeastern United States. Up to 100% of the bats have perished in those cave systems. So what we're seeing in Wisconsin is kind of the trend of what's been seen in other parts of the United States. And then the other thing that's kind of shocking about this is that they were able to find and type white nose syndrome. They were able to find the fungus in 3 additional counties, and those being Iowa, Dodge, and Lafayette counties. So the bats did not actually have white nose syndrome in those caves in those counties, but the fungus itself was found. And the shocking thing about that is in Dodge County is Nita Mine, and Nita Mine is an old iron mine, and it's the largest bat hibernaculum in the Midwestern United States, containing upwards of 200,000 bats. So the fact that it's in Dodge County means that eventually it's going to hit Nita Mine if it hasn't already, and that is going to have serious ramifications for bats, not just in our state, but bats in the Midwestern United States.
Well, Jamie Knack, is this a new thing? Has white nose syndrome been seen in Wisconsin before, and is this just a new disease generally in the bat population?
Well, the disease itself was discovered in Wisconsin, as David mentioned, in Grant County during last winter's surveillance efforts. But it's not new to the country. It started in New York, I believe.
Yeah, Albany, New York in 2006.
In 2006, and I believe it's probably right around 25 or more states that have had white nose syndrome confirmed. So it started in the East, and it's slowly moving into the Midwest and is likely to continue to expand in years to come.
Okay, so we know that in Wisconsin, at least we believe that it started in Grant County. How did it get there?
Again, through movements of bats within hibernaculums that were infected. So there's been sites in all of the neighboring states with the exception of Minnesota. So Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, all of our neighboring states have detected white nose syndrome, and those bats can still move quite a few miles, and once infected in a cave, bats move quite a bit, even during hibernation, and can expose individual bats. So it's pretty readily exposed, pass from one individual bat to another.
So the fungus that is the cause of this white nose syndrome, that exists on the walls of these caves and underground structures, and what do we know about the fungus?
Well, originally, so the fungus does occur in the cave systems on the walls, floors of the cave systems. And typically these caves are, roughly 50 degrees Fahrenheit and very high in humidity. So that's kind of the growing condition for this fungus. The only other thing I'll mention is Jamie's absolutely right that, that it has been documented that infected bats can move into an uninfected cave and infect that, that new cave system. So that's one of the ways that we'll transfer white nose syndrome, the fungus. But we have a lot of people who also are spelunkers or cave explorers. And as people go from cave to cave, that's another way that this can be transmitted. And so the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has done a phenomenal job of being very proactive because they've been monitoring the cave systems in Wisconsin for a number of years. I guess 2 years ago, maybe Jamie, 2 or 3 years ago, they listed our state resident species, those four bats, as state threatened species, which gives them an additional layer of legal protection. The cave community, the spelunking community, but we have, caves, like think about Blue Mound Cave here in I guess, Iowa County. There are a lot of cave systems where you can go as a member of the public and just go see what the cave looks like. And so the cave and mine operators, as well as the spelunking community, have been very, very good about collaborating and cooperating with the DNR and are really self-policing themselves so that they don't transfer this fungus any more than necessary from one cave system to the next cave system. So, for example, when they go into one cave system, they'll take all of their clothes off and they'll put completely new clothes on before they go to a second cave. And if they have cameras or anything like that, they'll wipe the camera down completely with a Lysol-based solution. And so people are trying to be very, very cautious about moving this. But again, unfortunately, once it's here, even though you might be able to control the human beings, the transmission route through humans, those bats are coming and going as they want. And even though we consider them state resident species, they are also considered a short distance migratory bat and, can fly upwards of maybe 200 or 300 miles from cave to cave.
800-642-1234 is the number to use to join our discussion. We're talking about wildlife this hour with David Drake and Jamie Nack, and with you if you care to join us. You can also leave a comment on the Larry Mueller Facebook page, Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, I should say, on Facebook, and or send us an email. talk@wpr.org is the email address. I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but coming back to this, no pun intended, coming back to this fungus, is this some kind of invasive species kind of thing that it just showed up and it isn't actually, it's a new thing that hasn't been seen in the U.S. before? Or is this something that's been around but has changed in some way and is now affecting the bats?
John, that's a good question, and I guess I'm not quite clear on that myself. At one point I was understanding that this was a naturally occurring fungus, but now I've been reading some other stuff that says it's an invasive, a fungus that's been introduced to the United States. And there's also a fungus like this. I believe it's the same genus species, but I'm not sure about that, but over in Europe. And the bats over in Europe either have developed immunity to this, or maybe it's not, as the fungus is not as potent. But the bats over in Europe apparently are living in cave systems with the white nose syndrome fungus over there, and they're not affected to the extent that our bats here in America are.
So we've seen a 70% decrease in bat population in Grant County. What are we noticing elsewhere in Wisconsin? And I guess maybe the next question after that is, what does that mean for agriculture? Because I think a lot of people miss the connection between bats and farming.
Yeah, I guess that's the big unknown question on that. Certainly... bats, as you mentioned early on in the program, they provide a tremendous amount of ecological services in terms of insect control and pollination and seed deposition and moving seed around, things like that. So people are not sure how it's going to affect agriculture and other things in our everyday life. So that's one of the unknown questions and something that is certainly to be studied.
Well, according to one statistic I read, the economic impact of bats is somewhere between $4 and $50 billion a year in terms of agriculture. That's a pretty big spread, but even $4 billion is a big number. What do they do for what's the function of bats in the in the scheme of agriculture, Jamie Knack?
Well, there are, as David mentioned earlier, our seven bat species are all insectivores, so they're eating primarily night flying insects, and they're catching them in the air as they are both flying. So it's really in terms of consuming and reducing the number of insects that then can affect agricultural crop production.
And I understand that they also aid in seed propagation and other things.
Primarily, that's going to be bats that are feeding on fruit. And, those are not bats we have here, but certainly in other countries. And many bats help pollinate plants by getting nectar from flowers and in turn getting the pollen on their bodies. So they, a really interesting website if people are interested in learning more about bats is Bat Conservation International, and it's bci.org. And they have some phenomenal videos and information about bat species around the world. So there are over 1,000 species that exist, and each of them have very specific ecological services that they provide.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what's being done to what else is being done in addition to what we've already talked about helping to stop the spread of white nose syndrome, and what citizens can do to help, and maybe what research is being done to see if we can find a solution to this problem. Talking with David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison, and Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, and with you at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller today. David Drake and Jamie Knack are with me. We're talking about wildlife in the state of Wisconsin. Have you recently seen any bats? What kinds of wildlife have you been noticing lately, and what are they up to? Do you have questions about a particular Wisconsin animal? We're talking about bats right now, but we won't be doing that for the entire program. And we'll be taking your questions about wildlife today at 800-642-1234. So we've talked a little bit about, keeping the fungus from spreading by telling people who go into caves to change their clothing and use cleaning supplies that would kill this fungus. What else is being done to prevent the white nose syndrome from spreading further? And what can citizens do to help?
Well, another thing that the Department of Natural Resources, and more specifically the Wisconsin Bat Program, would like people to do is, one, if they haven't already reported any hibernaculums that occur on their properties that the DNR may not be aware of, they would like to have those reports so that they can protect those important sites. And also, particularly from October through March, when the bats are hibernating, if you happen to see a bat flying around or on the ground or injured, that's an unusual occurrence in that typically they would be hibernating during that time. And this fungus causes bats to arouse during the hibernation time period. And then because they're all insect eating bats, if they're flying around, they need to replace those fat reserves that are lost by consuming insects, which is difficult. And that's basically these bats are starving to death in the hibernaculum when they're having long periods of awakening. So if somebody sees a bat flying around between the months of October and March, again, we encourage you to call the bat monitoring or the Wisconsin Bat Program, and you can get to their information through the Wisconsin DNR's call center number or off of their website.
All right. Well, we have people who want to ask questions about bats, and let's start in Janesville, where Jill is with us. Jill, hello.
Hello. Oh, I'm so excited to get a chance to talk with you guys. I've tried a few times to reach the DNR. I'm a physician and have worked with people with stubborn fungal infections, respiratory infections, using essential oils that they inhale. And I've been trying to get a hold of somebody to see if any of these oils that have been proven to be effective against other fungus species have been tested on this fungus.
Yeah, Jill, thank you for your question. Not to my knowledge. And so one of the issues is trying to figure out how to slow this fungus down or either retard the growth or allow the fungus to perhaps grow but not affect the bats. And so people are very cautious about trying to do this because these bat ecosystems are very sensitive and kind of tricky. And so it's a little bit like kind of unlocking a puzzle. If you take one piece out, how is that going to have an effect on other parts of that ecosystem within the cave system? And so people are really trying to be cautious about this. There has been a little bit of research going on down in Georgia where people have grown a common bacterium in a petri dish, and that bacterium has been shown to slow the growth of the white nose syndrome fungus. And then they took that from the lab and introduced it into a couple of caves in Missouri and Kentucky. And apparently, I guess people are cautiously optimistic that it might have worked, but there's still a lot of research left to be done. And again, nobody's quite sure about how this is going to upset that balance within that cave ecosystem. So the short answer to your question is no, nothing's been found to be demonstrated that it's effective to protect bats from white nose syndrome in those cave systems right now.
Jill, thanks for your question. We had a caller, Margaret, who wanted to know if bat houses would be helpful.
Well, that's a good question, and certainly they are helpful for the species in general, but because our four cave bats hibernate in larger caves or hibernaculum, so they, as David mentioned, are short-distance migrants. They'll actually congregate in a cave, like David mentioned, the Needy Mine in Horicon, and overwinter in a larger cave system where there's better controlled microclimate for them than what a bat house would provide. So bat houses that people have in their yards are summer roofs. So that's where the bats go in during the daytime, during the summer months. And certainly that is helpful in terms of just providing habitat for bats, but it's not necessarily going to help them fight white nose syndrome.
Okay. Let's go to Mary in La Crosse next. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. Now that I'm listening to you, I actually have a second question. My first question is, my son has a farm in Vernon County, and he has a very old, very airy barn, and I don't know what kind of bats he has, but in the summer they come out in, it looks like the hundreds. And so my first question was, will those be infected, or is it only in caves? Then my second question is, on his farm there is a very small cave that's kind of big enough to get into. We figure fox probably live in there because there are rabbit bones and things like that. So I guess my main question is, what is the possibility about it affecting those that live in airy barns? Thank you.
So thanks for the question, Mary, and just to kind of follow up with what I was explaining with Margaret's question about the bat houses. But those bats, again, Vernon isn't too far from some of the other counties, Richland, Grant, that have detected white nose syndrome. So those bats, should they hibernate in a cave with that white nose syndrome, are certainly susceptible to it. Can't say for certain where those particular bats on that farm are overwintering, but I would definitely consider them, susceptible in the years to come here. But they are not overwintering on the barn. So they're moving to those greater caves, mine systems to overwinter.
How would I know if I had a bad hibernaculum on my property?
It would take a little bit of investigating by someone who is familiar with that, but essentially trying to get access and using a flashlight and trying to determine if bats are coming in and out. You could look for droppings and things like that as well during the summer months when they're likely to be using other summer roosts. And that's what I was going to suggest to her, is that she may want to just go ahead and contact members of the Wisconsin Bat Program, send them an email, let them know as many specifics about the cave as you can, location, relative size, height, you know, things like that, that you can provide in a descriptive email, and then see if it's something they're interested in coming out and having a look at.
Let's take another question. We'll go to Lynn in La Crosse next. Lynn, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a solitary bat that lives on an enclosed, a covered porch. It's a small porch. The bat hangs out there at night where the roof meets the wall. And it's just one bat. And I know it hangs out there at night because when I go out in the morning, I sweep the droppings away. About a week and a half ago, this bat did hang out there for the whole day. And I called the DNR to find if maybe something was wrong with it. And they said, no, that's not unusual. You know, see what happens tomorrow. And the bat disappears during the day, but I know it's there at night because when I come, get up in the morning and go out on that porch, the droppings are there, but the bat isn't, except for that one day. And this bat has been there doing this for 2 years now. Of course, not during the winter, but 2 years. And it's just one bat, and I'm just curious what kind of bat that might be.
Lynn, that's a good question. So we have obviously the different bat species in the state. It may be the same bat because bats are long-lived animals, and so it may be the very same bat you're seeing for the last 2 years. It might be a different bat. I'm guessing it's probably going to be one of the big or little brown bat species. And so typically what will happen is it will go at night, and obviously bats are nocturnal, so they're active at night. And it might just go out and feed, come back and rest for a little while, go back out and feed. And then that particular day, it decided, hey, this is a pretty nice place to hang out. I think I'll just stay here and sleep for a little bit. So it kind of use that area as a day roost. And if you don't mind it being there, it's great, to have it just kind of hanging out there, and if you can just allow it to be continue to be there, I think that would be wonderful for the bat, and it'd be a good experience for you as well. And it's kind of neat to have them around. It's kind of fun to see them. They're obviously the only flying mammal we have. They're, as we mentioned, they're very good for insect control and for some other ecosystem services. And so, if it's okay to have them there, we'd encourage you to let it be.
All right, Lynn, thanks. Thanks for that question. Here's a comment from a listener who posted on the Larry Miller Show Facebook page. This is from James, who writes, on a trip to the Ozarks in Missouri a few weeks ago, several caves were closed due to the white nose syndrome. However, several other caves were open, and one tour guide mentioned that a cure had been found. As to why their bats were okay and as opposed to the bats in elsewhere. He didn't elaborate, so James is wondering, has there been progress in Missouri on a solution to white nose syndrome?
Hi, James. Thank you very much for your question. I'm probably guessing that what that cave tour guide was kind of pointing at was this possibly promising but very preliminary research that's come out of Georgia State University looking at this common bacterium and using the bacterium to slow the growth of the fungal disease. And as I mentioned, they did move that off the bench or out of the lab into a couple of different caves in Missouri and Kentucky. And I'm assuming that's what he's talking about. But there has not been a cure for white nose syndrome at all. And why their cave is okay, if it is perhaps because they're taking extra precautionary measures to make sure that the fungus is not allowed to come into their cave system. But it very well may be that they have the fungus in their cave and they may not be aware of it yet as well.
So what's our thinking, what's the best thinking today about in terms of the bat population being restored, assuming we can solve the white nose syndrome issue? You mentioned, David Drake, that bats are long-lived. How about their reproduction cycle? Are they able to reproduce in numbers that would allow them to repopulate quickly?
No, not at all, and that's the concern. Is unfortunately, prior to white nose syndrome, bats were not a very well-studied group of animals, and so we don't know a lot about them. We do know that they're long-lived. Generally, they have very low reproduction, so they might have, at the very most, depending on the species, they might have three pups in a season, but usually it's just one or maybe two in a season. So they don't reproduce very quickly. And then the other issue is we have no idea about their demography, so we don't know about how many individuals there are, even within the population. We don't even have a rough population estimate necessarily for some of these species. So we don't know how many individuals are in the species. We don't know the age and sex structure. So we don't know if, for example, a particular species is heavily loaded with mostly adults that are going to perish soon or die soon, and there's not many young to replace them. So things like that. And then on top of that, there's white nose syndrome is certainly taking its toll on the bats, but that's not the only cause of predation of death. So, bats are eaten by other animals. They die of other diseases. They are susceptible to death at wind facilities, so from the turbines. And so there's other things that are killing the bats out in the landscape. And the cause for concern is with this massive die-off from white nose syndrome, and then you have these other causes of mortality, is that putting these species over the edge, and they're not able to reproduce quick enough to replace those animals that are getting killed.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call with your wildlife questions. We're talking about bats, but we have some other questions that listeners have called in that we want to get to as well. Have you recently seen any bats? And what were they doing? What kinds of wildlife have you been noticing lately? Not bats, but anything. And what were they up to? And if you have questions about a particular Wisconsin animal, Jamie and David are happy to tell you what they know. Well, we had a caller on earlier who couldn't stay around, who had a question about why we're seeing rattlesnakes in central Wisconsin. Is that part of their natural range, Jamie Knack?
Well, we don't have the caller on the line to determine whether there was a positive identification there. Sometimes rattlesnakes are mistaken for a couple of our other common snake species in the state, of which we have approximately 20 species of snakes. The fox snake, or some refer to it as the pine snake, and also the eastern hognose snake can sometimes be mistaken for rattlesnakes or vice versa. So the two rattlesnake species we have, the eastern Massasauga rattlesnake, which is an endangered rattlesnake in the state, as well as the timber rattlesnake, are fairly uncommon, but also in pretty distinct habitats that they don't frequently, are not frequently in areas where humans are. So for instance, the Massasauga rattlesnake is along some of the larger river systems in the backwaters or flooded woodland habitat. And the timber rattlesnake tends to be found in some of the rugged bluffs in southwestern and western Wisconsin. So central Wisconsin along the Wisconsin Riverway, but anything kind of east and north of that, there are not many reports of these two rattlesnake species. So it may have been a case of mistaken identity, or perhaps the central Wisconsin that caller described is close to the Wisconsin Riverway.
Well, there's a reason why Diamond Bluff is called Diamond Bluff.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. And there's also a reason why I live in Superior, not south of here, because no poisonous reptiles. And our spiders are a manageable size.
Yes, well, you know, the rattlesnakes are pretty harmless. They take every precaution to not strike. I mean, that's the last thing they want to do. So they ambush their prey. They also stay hidden when we're near them or a dog might get near them. And it's only if you either mess with them or accidentally step on them or get too close that they may strike. But very few incidents of rattlesnake bites anymore.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Let's see. Let's go back to the phones. And Robert is in Middleton, and he has a question. Robert, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, actually. The first is I live in the country, and I have some holes in the wood structure that could perhaps contain bats. If they were there for sure, I'd just put in a bat excluder once the pup raising season is over. But the first question is, how might I know if there are bats in there? I don't want to cover those up and trap them if they are. And the second question is that white nose syndrome wakes up the bats, makes them use their energy source, so they basically starve to death. So why don't you go in a cave with a heavy infestation of white nose fungus and just feed the bats when they wake up? I'll take my answer off the air.
Robert, I'm afraid you're only allowed one question on this show. So, no, those are both good questions.
We'll make an exception. Right, we'll make an exception in this case.
Just
but
for
that's
you,
it.
Robert.
That's it.
Okay. So the first question about how would you know if you have bats in that structure? A couple of things. If you have access to where the bats are going, so for example, if they're going inside and perhaps if there's an attic, if you have access to that attic, if you would just go up there during the day and look around, so look in the rafters, if you have insulation up there, especially the baffle type or fiberglass type insulation, maybe, you know, just look around within the insulation. Look for areas where you might have kind of white crystalline droppings down perhaps the chimney if it's going through your attic or down the wood rafters. That indicates their urine. Look for their feces, which look like mouse droppings. Look for the animal itself. So that's one thing. If you don't have access to that area, then the best thing to do is just stand outside as the sun's starting to go down around those areas where you think the bats are coming and going in the structure and see if you see bats coming out of that out of those openings. And typically bats need an opening of about 5/8 of an inch, so just a little bit more than half of an inch to get inside of a structure. So that's about the size that you're looking at. And you're absolutely right that you do not want to exclude those bats if you have them in there, because they are we do have bats that will birth those pups, and sometimes they'll do it singularly where they're by themselves. Sometimes they're in these big maternal colonies, depending on the species. But if you separate the mom, where you use a bat excluder, and the mom goes out to feed and she can't get back in, then those pups are destined to death because they can't nurse. And we don't want to do that. So, and legally from, I believe it's May 15th until July 30th that you're
June
15th to July 30th, you're not allowed to exclude bats from a structure anyway, unless there's an immediate health concern like rabies or something like that. And the second question was
why can't we just, if the bats are being awakened by the white nose syndrome and starving to death, why can't we go in the caves and feed them?
Yeah, so, because they their physiology and their ecology is such that they will put on enough fat stores leading up to hibernation, and then they will actually hibernate, so they reduce their metabolism, they reduce their heart rate, their respiration, things like that, and they're not awake enough that you actually could feed them. And what would you feed them anyway? It would be very difficult to do that logistically. And if you wake those bats up, or even if they are awake, they're burning fat stores, and it would be very difficult to get them back into a hibernatory state.
It would also involve a lot of insects.
Yeah.
The average big brown bat can consume 600 mosquito-sized insects per hour.
Yeah, and I'm going to go on record as not wanting to see mosquitoes in Wisconsin in the wintertime.
Right.
I mean, it's bad enough we have them in the summertime, but, you know, we need a break. Okay, thanks for those questions, Robert. And let's go next to Ray in Rhinelander. Ray, good morning.
Hi. There's been a concern for myself and others about these places that advertise pest removal. They advertise getting rid of bats and a variety of different things. That's one question. Aren't they regulated? I'm sure they're mandated that they can't just, you know, get rid of these bats. What if they do get them, what do they do with them? And what is the numbers right now on the declining population on bats, however it may be, you know, whether it's just white nose syndrome or other things? How healthy is our bat population presently in Wisconsin? And I'll take the comments off the air, and thanks a lot for being on.
Thank you, Ray.
Well, Ray, in answer to your question about pest control companies, we often, David and I, get requests to recommend people. And that's not something that we do, but we give you advice on how to select somebody to work with. So you certainly want to call references, find out how they handle situations, look at contracts, look at how they deal with an animal's return after they've, you know, supposedly dealt with the problem and things like that. So that's one thing, is to really get to know who you're working with. Along those lines, though, those individuals have to follow state and federal laws just like you and I do as homeowners. It's just that they have the expertise, the equipment, and the experience to be able to handle nuisance wildlife or wildlife damage management situations as a profession. So they're willing to come out and remove a raccoon from a chimney, or they're willing to come and help you with a bat infestation, or bats that have a summer roost in your home. So in many cases, especially when we're talking about bats, they are working, again, with the state laws, which says that they're a threatened species. So you have to have a health risk, a demonstrated health risk, a reason to kill an animal or a bat. And usually that's an individual bat. So in terms of these colonies, they would be using excluders, as one of the callers alluded to earlier, and that time period would be in the spring or into the fall when you would use an excluder, which is basically a device that creates a one-way door. You put it over the opening, and the bats are able to fly out at night and feed on insects, but when it comes time to return, they're unable to get back through that opening because you've created a one-way door out of a piece of plastic or using some mesh screening or things like that. So I guess I would do your homework, and they are still subject to all state and federal laws when it comes to dealing with wildlife. And your question about bat declines, in the East, where white nose syndrome has been around a bit longer than here, as early as 2006, in some of those infected caves, we've seen 90% upwards of 100% reduction of that particular cave population of bats, and infecting a number of different species of cave-dwelling bats. And overall, I want to say that number is approaching up to 6 million, maybe even more, in terms of the overall estimate of bats that have died from white nose syndrome across the eastern and now the north central part of the country.
All right, thanks for that question. We'll take more of your questions in just a moment. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more with David Drake and Jamie Nack. We're talking about wildlife in Wisconsin. What wildlife are you seeing? What are they doing? What questions do you have? We've been talking about bats, but certainly there's lots of other wildlife in Wisconsin, and we see more of them probably in the summertime than we do in the winter. But what are they doing? What would you like to know about? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Also, you can leave a comment or a question on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, or reach out to us by email at talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we're talking about Wisconsin wildlife, and we've been getting an update on the white nose syndrome as it affects our Wisconsin bats. David Drake is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie Nack is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. So let's see. We've got a lot of questions. Let's go back to the phones. Oh, hang on. We'll take a Facebook question first. A Facebook question from Gina. Gina says, I recently bought a bat house and would like to hang it. Where is the best place to put it?
So the best place to hang a bat house, first of all, in Wisconsin or the northern states, you're going to want to paint it a dark brown or a black so that it absorbs more of the sun's heat. And then the best places to place them are either on a pole in the middle of an open area, because bats are insect eaters. They consume flying insects, so they need room to be able to maneuver. And another good location would be on a south or east-facing side of a barn or a building. You just want to be careful not to locate that bat house over a door below, because the droppings will, the way the bat houses are designed, droppings fall out the bottom. So in a location where you don't mind having some droppings accumulating on the ground, which do make good fertilizer if you want to collect them and use them in your garden. Also, if you happen to live or have a pond nearby, that's another really great place on a pole mounted near that pond, because then they're getting insects off the surface of the water as well. So those are some suggestions. And again, these websites, Bat Conservation International, the Department of Natural Resources website, have some excellent information on how to build a bat house, how to locate a bat house, or what if bats aren't occupying your house and you've had it up for a year? What are some tips you can do to kind of think about where you placed it and maybe come up with a better location?
And what should I expect to pay for a bat house?
Yeah, you can buy them. I've seen them in local stores here in the Madison area. A couple things to think about, or when you look to purchase a bat house, try to find one that's BCI certified, so Bat Conservation International certified. There's been so much research done on designs for various wildlife houses, whether it's for wood ducks or bluebirds, that you really should go through those organizations to either look at the designs that they recommend if you're going to build your own, or on locations on where to purchase a bat house that kind of meets their specifications in terms of a good design. And as far as cost, it really varies quite a bit. I would say anywhere from $40 on the low end and on up from there, depending on materials. And you can also build them in a variety of sizes.
Okay. And here's a non-bat question from a caller from Iowa. John called in to ask, when do bobolinks leave the nest?
Well, bobolinks are one of our grassland birds. They're going to be having young anywhere from about, well, laying eggs and establishing territories anywhere from May 15th through, I would say, early August. And in some cases, they'll re-nest if something happens to the their first clutch. But they are a bird that, you know, when they hatch, the young are helpless, so the adults need to feed them. And it's about 10 days, 9 to 10 days, that adult will care for those nestlings before they're ready to fledge and go out on their own.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Black River Falls, where Alex is on the line. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I have a question about bat droppings. I get large numbers of brown bats that roost under my eaves against my house, and so my deck and stairs, all sorts of things just get covered in bat droppings. And my wife is very worried about them as a disease transmission vector. How worried do I need to be about bat droppings, handling them, sweeping them? Can you vacuum them? What diseases do you need to worry about, and how should you treat them?
Alex, that's a good question. Typically, if you said you're in your front porch, so I'm assuming that it's in an open air environment. And typically, especially if the droppings are relatively fresh, that there's not a lot of concern about disease from sweeping it up and things like that. Typically, one of the diseases that would be of concern in as you are sweeping, especially dry droppings up in an enclosed area and you're breathing the dust, is a histoplasmosis. And that's a lung disease that you can get from bat feces. But typically, in your situation, I wouldn't be too concerned about it, again, because you're in an open-air environment, especially if the droppings are fresh. But if there's any concern at all, certainly wear some kind of a respirator on your face. It doesn't necessarily have to be a closed respirator, but one of those cloth masks you can get from the hardware store if you're painting or something like that would be beneficial. And if you want to wear perhaps rubber gloves, or certainly after you get done sweeping everything up, immediately go inside the house and just wash your hands with some soap and warm water for 30 seconds or so, and before you touch or eat food or put your fingers in your mouth or anything like that.
Alex, thanks for that question. And that reminded me, I meant to ask this earlier, this white nose syndrome, is that something that is transmissible to other animals?
At this point, I don't believe there's any information or evidence that it's transmissible to either humans or other animals.
All right. That's good to know. Let's go to Helen in Oshkosh next. Helen, good morning.
Good morning. My question is about red-winged blackbirds. and they have become a nuisance in our neighborhood. They dive bomb people who are out mowing their lawn. One neighbor even wore a helmet on her head for protection. Is there any way to control these birds or to discourage them from nesting in our area?
Helen, that's a good question. And red-winged blackbirds are one of the earlier migratory returning birds to our area. Obviously, they're a black bird with red wings. That's why they're called red-winged blackbirds. Typically associated with wetland areas, you know, cattail marshes and things like that. But they are also a scourge to a lot of farmers because they can do pretty substantial damage to corn crops and things of that nature. And as you've kind of correctly pointed out, one of the reasons you're probably getting dive bombed is that there's a red-winged blackbird nest or a number of nests in the general area where you're mowing and you're out and about. And blackbirds are pretty territorial, and they're pretty defensive of their nests. So once the nesting season is done, you won't have to deal with that. In the meantime, there's not a lot you can do. Unfortunately, the one thing you might want to do is try to scare them out of the area, and you can do that, you know, banging pots and pans or making noise or do something that is relatively kind of harassment in nature as the birds are out and about. But it's a difficult problem, no doubt. And unless you've got a permit, you are not allowed to touch those nests because it's a migratory songbird. They're protected.
All right. Thanks for that question, Helen. We had a caller, Mary, in Menominee, who wonders, will the avian flu affect the eagle population?
Well, Mary, from what I am aware of right now, there's just been one snowy owl carcass that was picked up along the shores of, I believe, Lake Michigan, might have been Lake Superior, that had tested positive for avian flu. But other than that, we have yet to really see any large noted impacts. And I would expect with species like the bald eagles in the state that we would certainly document that, because those animals are readily seen by others and turned in if you find a dead eagle on a lake or near a road or things like that, or even an injured or a sick animal is often reported and turned in to wildlife rehabbers that can then make those diagnostics. So I think if that's a trend, or we're going to see more individual animals or concern for the eagle population, that we're going to detect that pretty readily in the state.
All right, thanks for that question. Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Duluth, and Pat is with us. Hi, Pat.
Hi. My husband and I have seen, this is near Cornucopia, Wisconsin, on the south shore of Lake Superior, and inland. And when we're on a road there, you know, not a major highway, just a road, we've seen many mounds of sand. This is a sandy area with some oak trees and other vegetation and plants. But there are very large mounds of sand, and then you can see a hole there. And at first we thought perhaps they were fox dens, but there are so many of them that we were wondering, what do you know what they might be?
How large of a hole is in the ground?
Boy, I'm gonna say maybe like the size of a large cantaloupe.
Okay, so it's most likely badgers is what I would guess, but it also could be groundhogs of that size of a mound. And typically, what you would look for, if you want to go investigate it, you can look at the mound entrance and see if you see tracks there. Typically, badgers will have a little bit larger claw marks in front of the toes, a little bit more substantial claw marks in front of the toes. Badgers also will leave feces around the entrance to the burrow, and also sometimes you'll see carcasses of things that they've been eating on around the burrow. Whereas with groundhogs, you don't see any feces nearby. You don't see carcasses. Groundhogs are primarily herbivores. And you'd see a bit of a different track. You also are typically more likely to see the groundhog out and about because it's more of a diurnal or daytime active animal than is the badger. But those would be my two guesses.
All right, Pat, good luck in identifying the occupants of those mounds. A quick question from Mary in Madison. We're getting close to news time. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi. I live on the east side between 51 and the interstate, and Monday morning about 5:30, two coyotes went through my backyard. They came from east headed to west, and I was just wondering if there are any reports of any coyotes, you know, in town in this area.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for your question. Yes, there are coyotes that are living in Madison. As a matter of fact, a graduate student and myself are doing a project where we are capturing, live capturing and radio collaring coyotes and red fox in Madison. And there are coyotes over where you are for sure. And if you want to follow along on our progress, if you go to our Facebook page, UW Urban Canid, C-A-N-I-D, Project. So UW Urban Canid Project, and we've got a Facebook page up. You can follow along with our captures and our research and things like that.
All right. Thanks thanks for that question, Mary. We're going to continue our conversation about Wisconsin wildlife. After the news, we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more with our guests on the Larry Mueller Show. David Drake is with us today. He's a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. And Jamie Knack is also here. She's a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. We're answering, well, not we, they're answering. I won't be answering any of your questions. David and Jamie will be answering your questions about Wisconsin's wildlife. If you've got a question, here's how to get in touch. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also post to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we'll get to your question or comment as soon as we can. We'll be here doing this until 12:30 this afternoon, so be sure to get your questions in right away. Again, that's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a few minutes to take some more of your calls and questions on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Spring has opened the door for many of us to observe nature right outside that door. Today, we're learning about a special opportunity coming up this weekend to experience nature in our beautiful state parks and forests for free. Wow, that's cool. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jamie Knack is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, again, glad you could join us today.
Thank you very much.
And David Drake is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and an associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. David, thanks again for stopping by today.
Thanks, John.
So before we get to that state parks and forests for free thing, Jamie, you had something you wanted to say about the exclusion time for bats.
Yeah, I just want to make a quick correction to the dates I gave you. I just switched the numbers around here. And June 1st through August 15th is the exclusion period where bats are having their young. And if you're excluding bats during that time period, you're going to end up killing young bats that have not are not able of flying yet. So that is the time period with our cave bats being threatened species now that you are not allowed to exclude them from your home or a building. You have to do it on either side of that window.
Okay, so what do we know about the what can we talk about the experiencing nature in our beautiful state parks and forests for free?
Yeah, so June 6th and 7th this weekend, admission stickers are going to be waived for all of Wisconsin state parks and forests. Trail passes are waived for the state bicycle and all-terrain vehicle trails, and no fishing licenses are needed to fish state waters. However, if you are going to camp at a state park, you still do need to pay for the campsite, but your admittance would be free for the weekend. And in addition to all of the free opportunities, there are also a number of events going on with this free fun weekend as well. So there will be free fishing clinics that are going to be offered at a number of the state parks, as well as an opportunity, and this is available throughout the year, but you can actually try fishing out through the Tackle Loaner program. And for both of those activities, you can go to the DNR website and do a search for fishing clinics or for the Tackle Loaner program. And it's encouraging people to get outside, enjoy the natural resources, appreciate the natural resources, and hopefully take a young child with you, whether it's your own somebody you know, a neighbor or a grandchild, and get them interested in the great outdoors that Wisconsin is blessed to have. Lots of wonderful natural resource opportunities here in the state.
You should have permission, right, for the children that you don't belong to?
Yes. You need to have their parents' permission if you're taking a child other than your own.
Just checking.
Yeah, okay, yeah, good question. Yeah, great point to make. Well, you know, there are state parks in so many areas of the state. I mean, we probably all have them close by, and I have to confess that we have several beautiful state parks right near where I live, and I don't really think about going there that often, but this is a good reminder to get out there and enjoy those state parks that we have. We have some other wildlife questions here. Chris from Wisconsin Dells wants to know how you help a turtle that you find outside its natural habitat.
And Chris is not on the line, I'm assuming.
No,
the line is quiet.
No,
that's
Chris
fine.
Chris had to leave.
So my question would be to just get a little bit more description in terms of what he considers to be outside its natural habitat. But at this time of the year and in the early spring, turtles are moving between wetland and upland habitats as females are laying eggs. But also we've got hatchlings coming out for like the snapping turtles and so on, where we often encounter turtles crossing roadways. So I would... you know, sometimes even though our intentions are in the best interest of the animal, sometimes doing nothing is the right thing to do. So without knowing a little bit more, I'd encourage them to just leave the turtle as it is, unless it's in a roadway or in a parking lot where you might need to just move it to a safe location. And again, you should never do that if you're putting yourself at risk. So in a situation where a turtle is crossing the road and you're able to pull over safely and take it to the side it was going toward, feel free to do that. But your safety should come first. And I guess I would just offer that in many cases, Mother Nature knows best and knows what they're intending to do, and that turtle might be just fine.
Okay. Let's go to Paul in Madison, a caller who's actually on the line, and hear what Paul has to ask about. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I live in Madison, and I have urban chickens. A raccoon tore the wood doors off my chicken coop and got in. I'm wondering how small of an opening a raccoon can go through. And second, what's the effect on ground nesting birds of the raccoons?
Well, first of all, urban chickens end up being a source or an attractant for a number of predators. So David and I often deal with questions revolving around protecting urban chicken roosts. So it could be fox, it could be weasels, it could be badgers, it could be birds of prey like owls or hawks, and certainly raccoons as well. So just lots of temptations, lots of good smells coming from that area that you're always, the more of a fortress you can build around those chickens, keeping them in a penned area at night instead of free ranging during the night can certainly help as well. So you might have to trench in the ground, your fencing, so that it goes below ground so animals can't dig underneath and get access. And raccoons are really, really strong. They can tear open a cage trap or get into crevices or little holes and just, you know, really make them larger and bend metal and so on to gain access. So I would just reassess the chicken coop and see what you can do to strengthen it to protect against a lot of those animals. And then your question about impact of raccoon predation on ground nesting birds, they certainly are. They're a generalist by nature, so they occur in many different habitat types. And they're also a generalist in terms of their diet. They'll eat a lot of different food. They're often found around waterways where they're eating frogs and amphibians, other amphibians, crayfish, things like that. But they certainly will consume both eggs and nestlings of grassland birds. My master's research back in the early 2000s was on grassland nesting birds in southwestern Wisconsin, and I was looking to document the predator community on these grassland nesting birds. So I had little cameras set up on some of the nests that I found. And out of about 55 nests, 9 of them, the ones that failed, 9 of those predations were raccoons. So they were definitely the largest contributing predator to the failure of those nests. I would say with fragmentation and the changing landscape and more humans in rural areas, raccoons respond pretty favorably or adapt well to human-dominated landscapes. So they certainly are. So you can certainly do some things on your own private property. You can trap or hunt raccoons. or encourage others to have that or gain that, give that access to others to come in and help you control their populations.
Paul, thanks for the question, and good luck with those chickens. We have a question from Karen in Nisida about foxes next. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. My question is, well, we are lucky enough, or are we, to have a fox den about 20 yards from our back door. And we have watched for the last 6 weeks a mom raise her four kits, and it's been delightful. Now, the two of the kits are coming back every night, and they've moved, about 20 yards away from the original home. Do you think that these two are going to start a new den, and when do they give birth?
Karen, that's a good question, and I'm really, really happy that you've had the experience of watching these foxes. It is a remarkable thing, and they are super cute animals for sure. So typically, foxes will breed anywhere between January and March, typically January and February, and their gestation period is roughly just a little less than 2 months, so about 53 days or so. So they'll give birth, if they breed in January, they'll give birth near the end of February, or, you can work out the rest of the timeline for yourself. And then typically those fox are born blind and pretty helpless for first maybe 3 weeks or so, and then they'll start getting a little bit more capable, and as they get stronger and more bold, they'll come up above ground, and then they'll start traveling with the mom and dad and things of that nature. So foxes, they do typically occupy kind of a family group. But what will happen sometimes is near the end of the summer, the mom will start kicking those young, or the young of that year, out of the territory, so that she can start get rebred the next year, and then they'll get kicked out and will be off on their own. Will have to find their own territory. But what does happen sometimes is typically fox will have multiple den sites, and they'll move those kits from den to den occasionally, because those den sites start getting a parasite load inside of them, and so they'll move so that the mite parasites and ticks and things like that can kind of die down. When the kits are starting to grow before they're active enough to go out hunting with the parents, parents will bring back food for them. So you'll see the parents bring back squirrels and sometimes chickens. We just talked about Paul and his chickens, so that's a susceptible prey item. Rabbits, things like that. And so you can imagine how stinky that den gets with those rotting carcasses in the den as well. So they will move den sites periodically for a variety of reasons, and that might be what you're seeing.
All right. Excuse me. Thanks for that call, and let's take another question. Before we do that, I'll mention the phone number again, 800-642-1234. We're talking about wildlife in Wisconsin today on the Larry Mueller Show. Let's go to Baraboo, and Claire is with us. Claire, hello.
Hi, Glenn. Thank you. I'm sorry, John.
That's okay. I answered pretty much everything except late to lunch. So, Claire, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I have some fox questions also. I wasn't even going to ask this, but you brought up the chickens. Some neighbors of mine have domestic chickens. I live right in town, and we have a great fox population in my neighborhood, and apparently they're getting poisoned. Is that legal, number one? And number two, at least one of the foxes has mange. At least that's what my neighbors and I think it is. Very, very short or practically non-existent fur. And is that a concern that, should something be done? Like, should the DNR be called about that? Or are all the kits going to die from that? What happens with mange?
Yeah, Claire, so those are good questions. So the first one about killing foxes. So legally, if a red fox is on your property and it's causing damage, at that time, you are legal to kill that red fox. So hopefully people are not poisoning it. That's not the best way to
I don't believe poisons are legal, though. You cannot poison as a means for that lethal control.
Right. And so if that is being known, the best thing to do is contact your conservation officer for the DNR within your county and perhaps have them investigate that, because that is, as James says, is not a pleasant way to die, and it's not legal. So it is possible that the fox you're seeing has mange, and certainly they certainly are susceptible to mange, and that's not an uncommon issue with foxes. But they're also shedding their winter coat right now, and that might be what you're seeing as well. So if you and it can be either, actually rather drastic, some of the losing of the winter coat and having the summer coat come in. Sometimes you can see some very, very thick fur, and then there's a demarcation line, and you see short fur. And that is just simply from shedding. If the animal is actually losing hair and you see patches of skin, or you see skin over the course of that animal, one of the possibilities could be mange. And that there's a couple different types of mange, but the most common is caused by a mite, and a sarcoptic mange. And so depending on how severe the mange is, it can certainly kill the animal. Because it's an ectoparasite or caused by a mite, if the parent goes back to the den and is physically interacting with the kits, certainly the kits could get that mite and also may be susceptible to mange. Unfortunately, there's not a lot you can do about that. If you were to call the DNR or perhaps the animal control agent in your city, most likely there's nothing they would do for that animal anyway. And what will happen is either the animal's going to recover from that, or the animal's going to die from that, unfortunately.
Claire, thanks for the call. Let's go quickly to Julia, who's calling us from Minnesota today. Julia, thanks for joining us on the Larry Miller Show.
Hi, thanks. I'm excited to go to the parks this weekend. Can I fish as a Minnesota resident on the Mississippi River on the Wisconsin side?
Julia, I am not entirely clear, looking at this press release, whether that applies to whether the free fun day applies to residents only or non-residents as well. I don't see that explicitly stated. But as far as the fishing within the state, and you know, for sure for state residents, and you would need to clarify that with the non-resident status, it does include inland waters and Wisconsin side of the Great Lakes and Mississippi River. But I would encourage you just to double check that by calling the DNR's call center number, which you can get off of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website, and just inquire about non-resident status. I really don't want to lead you astray on that one.
Okay. Julia, thanks for that question. That's a great question. We had a caller who was wondering, David or Jamie, if either of you or both have a public email that they could use to reach you to send pictures in order to get help identifying animals.
Yeah, I think both of us would be happy to do that. My email is JL, my last name, N-A-C-K, so JLNACK at WISC, W-I-S-C, .edu.
Okay.
And my email is ddrake2, so D-D-R-A-K-E, the number 2 at wisc.edu, and perhaps we can put it up on the program page or something like that so people can access it.
Yeah, I bet we could get that up on the Larry Miller Show Facebook page. Toot sweet. Let's take another question. We'll go to Tomahawk this time. Dave is on the line with us. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Got a problem with porcupines. I have a garage and a cabin, and they do not bother the garage, but they're trying to eat the cabin up on me. And I'm just wondering, you know, what a person can do. I put a woven wire fence around it. That helped for a few months. Then they were able to climb that. Then I actually did barbed wire on top of that, and that helped for a while, and now they're climbing over that, and they're getting in, and they're just eating it up on me.
Well, Dave, this is David. So first off, you have a great name. But secondly, porcupines are certainly an issue up in the northern part of the state, without a doubt. And as unique an animal as they are, and they are really, really fun to see, but they're not fun to see as they're chewing on your house. And one of the things that's going on, and porcupines are in the rodent family, and they're a chewer because they've got to constantly keep those front teeth, the incisors, filed down. And one of the ways they do that is to chew on things. So a couple of things you can do. One of the things, since you've already got that woven wire fence established, as well as the barbed wire fence, the easiest thing to do is to if you can, move that barbed wire so that instead of it being straight up and down, it's actually starting to extend up and outward away from your house. And because porcupines are very good and adept climbers, but what will happen by extending that barbed wire fence outward is they can't necessarily hold their body upside down. And so they might be able to get up the woven wire fence, but then as they try to navigate that barbed wire fence that is up and outward, they're not going to be able to navigate that and get up and over. So you could try doing that. The other issue is a lot of times porcupines will chew on things that, where you have a 90-degree angle. So, for example, in the corner of your house. And one of the things you could do is take some sheet metal or hardware cloth, and where they're chewing, just staple or tack that exclusionary material over those chewed areas and drive them off of that area as much as you possibly can. So those are a couple of things you can do. If you're up there and around, if you see them, you can harass them out of the area if you want to. You can perhaps try to give them maybe a salt lick or some kind of a bait pile that they could they could go to and draw them off the house. That can be a bit of a hit or miss type thing because you might also attract more porcupines than you've started with that kind of a application. So be careful about that. But I think exclusion is probably your best bet, where you're either trying to keep them completely out of the area or you're trying to keep them off of the area that they're actually chewing on your house.
Dave, good luck with that. Let's go to another Dave. This Dave is in Summit, and Dave's got a question about swans. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Yeah, another Dave. So, I have a kind of unique question, I think. I own a trout pond, and years ago I had an old-timer. You know, the weeds are kind of growing out, and we had a lot of predators. He said, what you need to do is get a couple swans. And so I was going to get some swans, some mute swans. I kind of wanted to do the right thing and get the indigenous species, and the trumpeter swans had just come off the endangered species list a while earlier. So I actually found somebody out of state who bred them, and I got a couple of them. They have clipped wings, and they've done a great job. They keep the weeds down. They sit there and just graze all day long and keep the weeds down 3 feet below the surface, and they're beautiful birds. They keep away some of the predators that would eat the trout, like the blue herons and the otter and such, and even the geese. So I didn't know if they were a breeding pair, but a few years ago, or actually last year, she laid an egg and had a cygnet. So now the cygnet is over a year old, and she's sitting on 3 more eggs. And the cygnet's still hanging around. And so I had read up on it, and they said eventually they'd just fly away. But I'm concerned that maybe the swan didn't learn how to fly because it didn't see the parents to model that behavior.
Okay.
And the gentleman who I originally bought the swans from, I still had his number, and I called him, and he said he'd be willing to buy some of the cygnets back. But I don't know if you need a specific
Okay, point. We're running out of time, Dave, and I want to give David and Jamie a chance to respond before we run out of time completely. So what advice do you have for Dave about his swans?
Yeah, Dave, if you're still in the air, let me just ask you a quick question. Do you want the swans to remain there, or do you want to get rid of the swans?
Well, I like the two with the clipped wings. I mean, they're very happy, and they do a great job. I mean, it works out like a little ecosystem.
But you don't want the extra ones?
Yeah, I mean, they're starting to build up. There's 3 more that are going to be
added. All right, we got it.
So if you can try to almost separate the birds if you can, so keep the two you want there. Obviously, they're not going to be able to fly away because their wings are clipped, but try to harass the other birds that are able to fly, harass them out of the area, and you might have to just harass them day after day after day for a couple of weeks until you can eventually get them moved on. The other option is perhaps call the county biologist for the DNR in your area and see if they would be interested in coming and trapping and relocating those additional swans and putting them in other areas where either other swans are, or maybe they want to try to increase populations of swans in another area.
Okay, Dave, thanks for your question. Thanks for all the great calls and emails we've had. We had an email from Paul of the DNR who says, free fun weekend is for both residents and non-residents. The woman from Minnesota would be able to fish without a license on the Mississippi River as long as she was within the Wisconsin waters of the river. So there's your answer. We're out of time. Thank you to David Drake and Jamie Knack for a very informative hour and a half. I really appreciate both of you stopping in today.
Thank you.
This program was produced by Cheyenne Lentz, who also handled on-air production, and we had additional production assistance from the very capable David Potratz. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about reducing your waste using a new food waste app and recipes perfect for grilling out this summer. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network.